Hi, and welcome to the Cutaneous Connection, a podcast from the staff of Dermatology Times, aiming to provide you with the latest updates in dermatology, to exclusive interviews with leading industry experts, and a glimpse of what goes on behind the scenes. I'm your host, Morgan Petronelli.
Today we're discussing a COVID-19 dermatology registry created by the American Academy of Dermatology's COVID-19 Task Force, Massachusetts General Hospital, and the International League of Dermatological Societies, which was launched worldwide in April 2020. The registry has since seen over 1,000 submissions from frontline clinicians located in over 40 countries, including dermatologists, intensivists, pediatricians, and podiatrists, helping to identify and diagnose active COVID-19 through submitted skin findings. Let's dive right in. Today I have joining me Dr. Esther Freeman, Assistant Professor of Dermatology at Harvard Medical School, Director of Global Health Dermatology at Massachusetts General Hospital, and Principal Investigator for the American Academy of Dermatology's COVID-19 Dermatology Registry. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Freeman, for joining me today. So my first question is, can you explain why the AAD's COVID-19 task force decided to start a COVID-19 dermatology registry?
So back at the beginning of the COVID-19 epidemic, we didn't actually hear a lot of reports about skin manifestations very early on. We were more hearing about the pulmonary issues, the primary issues of COVID-19. So we actually initially, when we were starting to conceptualize capturing cases around dermatology and COVID-19, really before it had spread to the United States, we were more thinking of, well, we know we have dermatology patients that have severe, are immunosuppressed, and we have them on pretty significant immunosuppressive medications, for example, like biologics. And we were interested, okay, well, how is COVID going to interact with our dermatology patients? So as we were, that was kind of one of our original approaches. And as we started to build the registry, we were just starting to hear like a couple of reports of maybe there might be some skin findings. And so I thought, well, why don't we program it just in case, to capture some skin findings in COVID-19 in case they exist. And at the time, they didn't really exist. And little did we know that actually that was going to be 99% of the registry, and that only a tiny piece of our registry is really focusing on the other question, which is kind of the immunosuppressives and the other existing dermatologic conditions. So we kind of had this small inkling, and I proposed the idea to the AAD COVID-19 Task Force with the idea that registries are a great way to collect information from many different countries at the same time. And especially when we don't know a lot about a new epidemic or a virus, we don't really know what we're going to find. And so you do want to kind of, it's a way to collect cases very rapidly from around the world. And things that, separately in and of themselves might not mean much can really start to make a difference and form hypotheses when you put them together. So for example, you could be sitting in San Francisco and see one case, and isolated by itself, that one case might not mean much. But when you start seeing that people in Madrid and, all across Europe and Asia and the United States are seeing similar cases, then you can really start forming some hypotheses. So that was kind of the impetus behind it.
Can you also explain the process of putting this all together?
Yeah, so it happened very quickly. And I think this is really a testament to the international collaboration and the kind of spirit of collaborative effort that people were really, I think, joining people together, especially, it continued today, but especially at the beginning of the COVID-19 epidemic. So I proposed the idea to the AAD task force at the very end of March that we should do this registry. And after getting their support, we went ahead and programmed the database in about 48 hours, which is obviously pretty fast. And we went through ethical approval at Massachusetts General Hospital, Harvard Medical School. And then we actually also approached the International League of Dermatologic Societies for their support as well, because it's important that this is a truly international effort. So from start to finish, from the day that I proposed it to the AAD task force, to actually going live and collecting our first patient case, And this includes the whole ethics approval process, was actually only 8 days. So to give you a sense, that's normally a project of this scope where you're really setting up an international database that requires so much collaboration of so many people would probably be normally about a 6-month process. So I think the speed really shows it's kind of like an all hands on deck. Everyone was really interested in getting it up and running. And I think the other important piece about that is that the registry is not just targeted at dermatologists. So we as dermatologists are a great place to collect all of these skin manifestations of COVID-19, but we as dermatologists are not the only ones seeing the skin manifestations of COVID-19. In fact, half of our registry comes from primary care providers, emergency room physicians, intensive care units, because if you think about who's seeing the skin manifestations of COVID-19, patients are not necessarily going to make it to an outpatient dermatologist, especially if they're acutely ill. So I think it was really important that we were able to get the word out to the international community. And I'm so appreciative of all the dermatologists that have shared this with their other communities that are not just dermatologists to enter data, because I think that's the best way to get a full sense of what's going on.
And on that, what kind of response did you see from the medical community about this registry?
So it was really very swift. So within, I think, 2 days of launching, we already had, you know, our first 30 cases of skin manifestations of COVID-19. And I will say I've never reprogrammed a database so frequently as we had to reprogram this one, because literally as we were launching, you know, every day we would hear of a new possible skin manifestation and we would reprogram the database. So in the beginning, we were actually reprogramming it like every 6 hours as we were hearing in real time new and different symptoms that people were experiencing. So that was definitely a challenge and a journey for us. After the first 2 days, we ended up really seeing already our first 30 cases. And after just a few months, we were at 1,000 different cases from 40 different countries, which really, again, I think underscores the true international collaboration. And I'm so appreciative of the International League of Dermatologic Societies and Lars French for helping us to get the word out internationally. In terms of where we are right now, we are currently at 1,185 cases from 42 different countries, of which 323 patients are PCR confirmed COVID-19 positive and 69 are antibody confirmed positive. So it's been interesting to see over time also how the cases that people have been putting in has changed. Because certainly in the beginning, very few people had access to COVID testing. So we had a lot of presumed cases where patients had a relative who was COVID positive or a spouse who was COVID positive or a parent who was COVID positive, but they themselves could not access testing. And that was certainly true here locally in Boston, where I'm speaking to you from, whereas now we can have much better access to COVID testing. So it's kind of hard to rewind ourselves back to March and April when it was, you know, you had to move mountains to access a COVID test.
Absolutely. I know it's crazy. Even here, it's sometimes even hard to get a COVID test. I live near the Cleveland Clinic, and my boyfriend actually works as a police officer there. And back in March, they were working, you know, 12-hour shifts, like 5 days a week. And, you know, they might have to go back to that now because now they're opening the COVID testing site even, or normally it would shut down around 5 or 7 o'clock, and now they're opening it till 9. So, and he's saying, yeah, we're seeing extreme spikes. Oh, it's crazy out there. But my next question, what types of skin manifestations are being reported to the registry? Were there any skin symptoms that were being commonly reported?
Absolutely. I think the one thing that was particularly surprising to me that I think has received a fair bit of media attention is around pernio or chilblains, also commonly known as COVID toes. I think the reason that was particularly surprising is that traditionally that's not something we've seen with other viruses. Well, I should say, we don't know that it's something we've seen with other viruses. It's possible that there's some aspect of pernio or chilblains that has always been virally mediated and we just didn't know it. But it's not one of these things, you know, normally if you get chickenpox or herpes or some other virus, you don't normally get purple toes. So I think that has been one particularly surprising thing that has come out of COVID-19. We are seeing that is our most commonly reported skin symptom in the registry overall. When you restrict the analysis down to those who are lab confirmed, it's our second most common. So it's still very common, but when you just restrict down to lab confirmed, our most common is morbilliform eruptions. Morbilliform is our more general viral eruption. It's very nonspecific. We see it in lots of viruses. And I think if you had asked dermatologists, you know, beforehand, if there was a new global pandemic caused by a virus, what rash would you expect to see? I think everyone probably would have said morbilliform, because that's kind of our most common, more generic viral rash. So that is what we're seeing most commonly in our lab confirmed cases, is morbilliform, followed by the perineo or chilblains, which we are seeing in lab confirmed cases, which I want to reiterate, because I know there's been some question of, oh, is it just people kind of walking around barefoot during the COVID epidemic? And I just want to reiterate that we are seeing this in lab confirmed cases. And in fact, there is data from other papers that where we're finding the SARS-CoV-2 virus in people's toes. So I just want to make sure that's clear about that connection. But we're seeing other etiologies as well, other manifestations of COVID-19 on the skin also. So for example, there have been reports of Grover's-like rashes on the chest. There have been reports of vasculitis, certainly quite a few reports of urticaria or hives. So I think what's interesting is just that one virus can cause so many different skin findings. It's not like there are three, there's kind of like 25. So I think that's been really interesting. And I think in some ways that mirrors what we see with COVID-19 in other organ systems. If you think about that, one person with COVID-19 might have, you know, fulminant respiratory failure and end up in the ICU. And another person can just lose their sense of smell or taste. And so in a way, we're almost seeing that with the skin. One person can have like a very big dramatic response, and one person can have something very mild. The other point I wanted to make on these different skin manifestations is that the severity of COVID-19 seems to vary based on the skin finding. So on one end of the spectrum, our most patients with our most mild COVID-19, those are the patients that we're seeing with COVID toes or perineo or chilblains. So of our patients in the registry who have perineo or chilblains, only 16% were hospitalized with COVID-19. So it seems to travel with relatively mild disease. Now at the far other end of the spectrum, we have patients who are very sick. So patients with retiform purpura, for example, this is a condition where you would have a net-like bruise-like pattern on the skin that's actually caused by small clots, which is very different than perineo, which is not caused by clots. That's inflammation. So with retiform purpura, this where you're getting small clots under the skin, 100% of our patients were hospitalized, and over 80% of them were in fulminant respiratory failure. So I think it shows you that these different skin findings really travel with different severities of disease. So one of our more recent publications from the registry has been looking at timing of COVID testing. And I think this is really important to understand, is that when you do PCR testing and when you do antibody testing really matters. It's not just did you do the test, but when did you do the test? And so one of our recent publications was looking at the idea of test timing, and this was published in the JAD, and how likely is it to be positive depending on when you do the test and when the patient's skin symptoms have started. The reason I bring this up is that one of our conditions, perineo chilblains, also known as COVID toes, tends to occur after acute infection. And it really seems to vary by patient. It can be anywhere between 1 and 4 weeks after acute infection. So it can occur while the patient is still PCR positive. And so in fact, in our registry, 15% of our patients with and that are entered in the registry with perineo chilblains or COVID toes, depending on what you want to call it, are still PCR positive at the time that they are tested when they develop perineo or chilblains. The reason this is relevant is that it's, you know, that means that 85% of them in the registry were not. So lots of people may be negative for COVID when they develop the toes, because they might be developing the toes, you know, 2, 3, 4 weeks after their acute infection. And I've actually had several patients myself that have developed their toes much later. So they are going to test negative for acute COVID. It's important to understand that doesn't mean they didn't have COVID. So, you know, patients will ask for a definitive answer, and it's actually kind of hard to give them that answer. You know, were other people in their family COVID tested positive at that time? Did they have other symptoms? It can be a little tricky to figure out. So I think it's important to understand, if you have a negative PCR test, it doesn't mean you didn't have COVID. It just means you don't have acute COVID in that moment. I think the other thing that's really tricky and that's been you know, far more complicated than I imagined, is antibody testing. I think at face value, it's very easy to say, oh, I did a commercial antibody test on my patient and it was negative, that therefore they never had COVID. It's actually much more complicated than that. Number one, when you do the antibody test really matters. So we saw certainly early on that a lot of people were antibody testing very rapidly after COVID infection, and the Infectious Disease Society of America now recommends that you don't antibody test someone for about 3 to 4 weeks after infection. So certainly antibody testing someone 10 or 15 days later, you know, you're more than likely going to see it be negative. I think the other thing that's really interesting is that there's increasing data that not everybody produces the same kind of antibody response, and that patients with mild or moderate disease, which really encapsulates probably most of our dermatology population, not all, but most, may not mount significant antibody responses. Also, they may not mount the traditional antibody responses. So traditionally, if we're looking for IgM or IgG, it looks like a lot of patients may actually be mounting an IgA response, which isn't even tested for on commercial antibody tests. So I just want to bring this up to point out that if you are antibody testing someone and you have very good reason to believe they had COVID, they may not be positive on a commercial antibody test. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they didn't have COVID. I think the other piece that's tricky is that we don't even know that antibody responses are the main drivers. Because we're also seeing that T cell responses, which would not be measured by antibodies, may be an important driver in, you know, host immune control of the virus. So I think the antibody story, you know, continues to be complicated. And if you're listening to this in, you know, January, and we're recording this in early December, there's probably going to be about 15 new stories about antibodies by the time you're listening to this. So it's probably, it's always a little dangerous with COVID to record something, because by the time it goes live, the story has probably changed. So you can look back and see what additional pieces of information we have about it. But I think the antibody story continues to be very complex, and particularly for patients with mild and moderate disease.
Absolutely. That's really interesting, actually. And my last question, you know, what do you have to say about the team you worked with to put this registry together?
So I've just been so appreciative of the fact that it's such an incredible collaborative spirit. And I think that this collaboration really extends beyond dermatology. One example of this is early on when we were starting the registry, the Global Rheumatology Alliance, who was doing a rheumatology registry, it was about 7 to 10 days ahead of us, which doesn't sound like a lot, but in COVID time, that's like 7 months of experience. And so they were very kind. I reached out to them when we were setting up our registry, and they were able to share with me, for example, their process of going through ethics and IRB approval, which saved us a lot of time. And so that was, you know, the fact that people in another specialty were willing to say, hey, this was our experience, this is what worked, this is what didn't work, we suggest you do it this way, saved us a huge amount of time and meant that we could go live very, very quickly. And so I'm really appreciative of that. I think also what's been great is having, for me, the COVID silver lining has been meeting so many new collaborators, you know, certainly across the United States. I had actually not previously worked, for example, with Lindy Fox, who's at UCSF. I hadn't worked previously with Samal Desai. I had not worked, you know, closely with George Haruza or Bruce Thiers. And so for me to have this opportunity to work with a lot of dermatologists that bring very different perspectives to the table has been really helpful. Also, another example, Marla Spasset, who's an immunologist and dermatologist at UCSF, has really been working through the immunology with us to try to understand some of the timing issues about testing and why someone might test negative when they test negative and what does that mean, and not just taking that at face value. So for me, just being able to collaborate across the US has been fantastic. And then also internationally, as I mentioned before, so appreciative of Lars French, who's the head of the International League of Dermatologic Societies, for really, I think, breaking across these borders and groups that don't necessarily always talk to each other and kind of coming together with the idea that we need to feed information back to our front line. Dermatologists have a role in this epidemic. And it's not just as a bystander. We have a role in diagnosing patients with COVID-19. We have a role in understanding the host immune response to COVID-19. And because the skin can really be a window into the soul, you know, we actually play a critical role in this epidemic. I think that's really my key message.
That's awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining me today, and you have a great day.
For more Dermatology Times content, from articles and videos to podcasts, you can visit www.dermatologytimes.com.